Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nearly half of Ohio's Black residents faced discrimination in the past year, and most believe that hard work alone won't get them ahead. That's according to a recent survey by the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus Foundation and the Bliss Institute at the University of Akron. The poll also found that the opinions of African-American Ohioans on the issues of the day don't fall into neat boxes of conservative or liberal. Crime, drugs, and guns top the list of the most important social topics for the 1,500 people interviewed for the first of its kind poll, but most favor small government and gun rights and abortion rights and stricter environmental laws. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Happy Corona Monday, Ann.
Happy Corona Monday. Sounds like a beer. You know, you used to do the survey for the Dispatch
right.
for many years, so... Number one, I guess I was surprised, but call me naive, that that was the first of its kind.
Well, I think concentrating in on the minority population, when you do overwide statewide polls, of course, you have African-Americans often as a subgroup. Part of the problem is, since African-Americans are plus or minus X percent to about 12% of Ohio's population, mm-hmm. the sample size in a statewide poll just is not enough. You know, to have a valid poll that goes really deep on that. But if you hone in, you oversample and all that, then you can discuss, you know, what this minority slice of the population is really facing, is really, really feeling and really thinking.
Were you surprised by any of the results?
I don't think so. I think what it underscores is... good grief, we stereotype mm-hmm. every group in this country, but... there actually is diversity within blacks. We being the political talking heads, if you will, we tend to treat African-Americans as this monolithic group, just like we do, whatever, Catholic voters or evangelical voters or whatever. And, you know, this underscores what we actually know to be true, that there is a bit of diversity within those ranks, within any people group, but, you know, in this case, among African-American Ohioans.
They're not one-issue voters, obviously, though, because there isn't a candidate that would meet all of those needs.
It's true. And one of the things that the poll from University of Akron was kind of showing, and John Green, the director over there, was talking about, was African-American voters are overwhelmingly registered as Democrats, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't consider themselves to be conservative. And so even within labeling yourself as a Democrat, there is a lot of variety there. I think when you look at things like most people said that they support gun rights, most and kind of access to firearms, that might tie in with like crime and drugs being the number one issues that they put even above things like healthcare, which have been really big sticking points for Democrats nationwide. That's like one of the top issues that they're talking about, but that's not the top issue among Black voters in Ohio, according to this poll. And so it's just interesting to see the differences between what Democrats are talking about and what maybe Black voters want to hear.
Does it matter?
Well, to the extent that having the best information possible to lay the groundwork for policy discussions at any government level, I would hope it does. I mean, the one result that I think a lot of people probably found discouraging was the 58% of Black Ohioans said they could work hard, but still not get ahead in this state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would be intriguing to take a similar poll, say Appalachians or what have you, but that's something. That runs counter to this American ideal, the work ethic, if you will, that we've all kind of, or at least many of us, have grown up with. You know, you work hard, you play by the rules, you'll get ahead in this country. And a strong majority of minority voters are saying, ain't so.
And that discrimination piece, too.
Mm-hmm. And I asked Ohio Legislative Black Caucus president, Stephanie House, a representative from the Cleveland area, and then also the president of the foundation, Barbara Sykes, a former lawmaker. I asked them what surprised them most about the poll, and they pointed to that statistic that Daryl just quoted about people feeling like they can't get ahead in Ohio. I think that was something that surprised even Democratic lawmakers who've been working on these issues. And then I asked them why they wanted to kind of get a vibe on discrimination. They asked, you know, whether you had experienced discrimination in the past year, and something like 46% said at least once, and it was something like 14% for frequently had experienced discrimination in the past year. And they basically were like, you know, if you're asking Black voters about something, this is an issue that, you know, is important to address. So it was something that they wanted to get a better pulse on, I suppose. Nothing that really surprised the individuals in that room, who were predominantly African Americans themselves. But it was something that we haven't really been able to nail down with like a number before.
And you know, those who've been discriminated against in the past year, I guess I'm not sure it's in the past year, but of course, Amelia Sykes herself, the House Minority Leader, Democrat from Akron, would probably put herself on that list because she was stopped by security in the state government buildings.
Even though she had a pass on her
and identifying her
as a member of the Ohio General Assembly.
Yeah, and she just, as she tells it, she just didn't look like a legislator. So, you know, to think that stuff like that happens in, you know, 2020 or 2019 when it actually happened, it's like that sets you back. And again, back to this bigger picture, sort of this bit of hopelessness, I think that dynamic is felt beyond the minority community in Ohio. I think, frankly, that Donald Trump tapped into that a lot in 2016 about, hey, we're out here playing by the rules, but we can't get ahead. Something unfair is happening, you know, and Donald Trump comes in and says, yeah, you're getting screwed over. Pardon the language, folks. But so vote for me and, you know, I'll fix your woes. And a lot of people said, well, we got to lose.
Yeah, but
that's exactly what he said at a certain point.
Well, and of course, and as many of your listeners are probably saying to themselves, well, okay, it's 4 years later now. How did all that turn out? And that's going to be one of the key questions as to who wins this state this year. Not to get ahead of our subjects, Ann, but.
No, that's okay. I mean, presidential race, politics plays into all of this. It's pretty much a two old white man race for the Democrats out there right now, which will make it a two old white men for the top of the, you know, for president in 2020.
Are you selling Tulsi Gabbard short? Is that what you're saying?
Tulsi Gabbard is still in, but
not really in.
Not really.
Who would have thunk this? You know, even a month ago, frankly, that we'd be down to this. And just the groundswell that we've seen for Joe Biden on the Democratic side in the last 2 weeks.
With the endorsements or just the vote numbers?
All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. And because they all kind of feed on each other. And it's, you talk about that Joe-mentum thing that's going on. You know, the Friday before the South Carolina primary, it was like, you know, we doing one of those pleasant things we do in the news business is type up obituaries ahead of time. There are a lot of political obituaries being typed up for Joe Biden. But then Congressman Clyburn comes out and endorses him. That really helps in South Carolina. He wins South Carolina. Not just a victory, but pretty much a blowout win over Bernie Sanders. And Super Tuesday does really well. Now going into Super Tuesday 2, I guess, is the rubric for tomorrow's voting. If Bernie Sanders doesn't win Michigan, the hill has suddenly become very, very steep for a Vermont senator.
It gives caution to the idea of early voting.
Well, it does. And that's, we have interns frequently at the Dispatch, and that was on day one of early voting. That was my assignment to him. Go and find out who shows up on day one of early voting, because you remember early voting in Ohio was mid-February.
Right.
You know, it's basically a month out. So this is
a different election.
Before South Carolina and everything. Yeah, we're basically have Iowa and New Hampshire in the books then. So it's like, really? I can see the diehards, or if you're attached to one of the campaigns, but there's been very high turnout in early voting. Now maybe those are all, or majority Biden and Sanders voters, but I doubt it. A lot of people have voted, and their presidential votes are, you know, not going to be. I mean, they'll be counted, but they won't count for anything.
It won't matter.
Obviously, the down ticket races, presumably they voted in those as well, and you know, obviously those candidates aren't changing. Nobody's withdrawing for county commissioner or what have you.
Hmm. The folks who have already voted are kind of sidelined at this point. Do you think that narrowing the race to these two guys, to Biden and Sanders, brings out the vote on primary election day?
It's hard to say. I think it's one of those. There has been a lot of enthusiasm from Democrats ever since President Trump was elected. You look back to the women's marches and to the various protests. And for Democrats, this is the first real opportunity to cast a vote that moves the needle towards taking Donald Trump out of office potentially. And so I think that alone will get them excited. But if you're excited because there's a wide slew of primary options and you really want to be there for Andrew Lang or Kamala Harris or, you know, one of the less likely to win candidates, then no, that's not going to bring you to the polls. The first numbers were actually for early voting were actually pretty small. And I think that was indicative of people waiting until after Super Tuesday to see what this field was going to end up being. I think you're going to have some people who, you know, always wanted to cast a vote for Elizabeth Warren who have already done that. Mm-hmm. But the people who are more kind of pragmatic, maybe weren't as committed to a candidate, were perfectly willing to wait to see this sorted out to a smaller number.
And that's the, you know, my earlier comments, I didn't mean to just totally write off Bernie Sanders, of course. But again, this groundswell I've been talking about, you know, just over the weekend, Kamala Harris, a senator from California, endorsed Joe Biden. Cory Booker, you know, senator from across
Everyone waiting on eggshells for Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, that's the only hope. And even locally here, as the Inquirer reported this morning, Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley and others down south are all endorsing Warren, as we reported up here.
Biden.
For Biden. Thank you for correcting me, Jesse. And Mayor Ginther from Columbus endorsing Biden and a bunch of other folks. Now, again, it's not that their endorsement per se has made, now I see how the mayor's voting. Now I can decide, I know who to vote for. But again, it's just this whole groundswell. The whole party seemingly
creates an energy, no doubt about it.
No doubt. Now, Jesse Jackson did come out over the weekend.
What'd you make of that? Does he figure much?
I mean, still, it's something. At least it's a flag that the Bernie can show out there. I mean, you know how it works. And we get news releases when the assistant associate former deputy dog catcher endorses. Bernie's had nothing to show, basically, since South Carolina, of people coming his way. So, as you know, Jesse astutely indicates, you know, Elizabeth Warren is sort of the main wild card out there. And as many of you are listening, you know, many folks out there listening know, you know, she asked for a little time to breathe here. You know, we reporters,
she had SNL to do too, you know.
Well, she had SNL.
Not too shabby.
That was interesting, wasn't it? That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah. Not too many candidates speak with the reporters after they end their campaigns, so you got to give her a little credit for that.
Give her some class for that. And of course, we ugly reporters, like, okay, you're out of the race. Who are you backing now? How about now?
Yeah.
You know, we're always moving on. Like, yeah. Well, exactly. Just step over the body and let's move on to the next thing. So, yeah, the news cycle never sleeps and never stops being on steroids these days.
Well, let's just take a break. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. With me today, Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. We will be right back with more on news and politics and public affairs. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Balmert and Columbus Dispatch public affairs editor Daryl Rowland. Let's talk about the coronavirus. Ohio began testing for COVID-19 coronavirus over the weekend. Governor Mike DeWine and state health officials had a news conference on Saturday providing more details about the process. Daryl Rowland, what's going on?
So far, no corona has been identified in Ohio. I think everyone knows it's only a matter of time, of course, that first positive test is going to come back, and then a second, and then we'll see what happens. I think this is what has people shook, that it's, you know, we all know, you know, deep in our hearts, of course, the flu is inherently, you know, we're much more likely to get that. Corona is a little more scary because, at least early numbers, the fatality rate, you know, you'll get sicker from it. But it's the unknown, I think, that has people shook, that has people a little bit scared and has us acting a little bit crazy here, cleaning out stores of hand sanitizer.
It really is true.
Toilet paper. Now, what's up with that? Okay, we're talking about maybe having to, like, self-isolate or self-quarantine, which, by the way, Ted Cruz is doing. And another member of Congress is doing, because they shook hands at CPAC.
At CPAC with that person who got it.
Typhoid, whoever he was.
Yeah, right.
So they are self-quarantining. So I'll be nice, Democrats. That's what I say. So, yeah, so far, you know, Ohio's been good. And, you know, they've discovered in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Kentucky. So it's like
Michigan and Ohio are. One of the things is,
though,
that Ohio just got the testing kits.
Well, that's the other thing, and that's still a story that it's working its way out. We were, you know, here in Columbus, we were focused a lot on the partial or most cancellation of the Arnold, because it's such a huge event for this community, drawing in at least a couple hundred thousand people to this town. I mean, Ann, you've been around here and just all those people with interesting-looking bodies walking around.
Yes, sirree, Bob.
and the trade show and everything. And, of course, the competition went on. Very limited spectators went on. So everyone's concentrating on that. But as my colleague Rick Ruin actually wrote a short story that we just put inside on this was, you know, the whole reason for this is because Ohio could not get the testing kits. We got testing kit number one from the feds. Guess what? It was broken, or it was faulty, I think was the original language. So otherwise, in Ohio, you had to send, you know, do your testing here, but send it away to the CDC for analysis, which took at best 3 to 5 days, sometimes a week. Well, you're talking about this huge festival. I mean, if you're teetering on the brink of canceling, not canceling, you can't be waiting 3 to 5 days, because then you're into the heart of it. So, but it, again, I think that story plays out. And, of course, we got to make this political like we do in this country about it's Trump's fault. Oh, no, Trump's been the insightful one or whatever. But, hopefully the medical people and the health people would prevail in this whole discussion.
I will be curious to know what the protocol was for doling out the kits, why some states got the kits before others and that kind of a thing. You know, they also, interestingly, don't have any down in the Deep South. That seems highly unlikely as well.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of information to be known about how these kits were doled out or when they were available, et cetera. I mean, when the first two suspected cases happened in Ohio, down near Miami University, of course, they sent those tests off to the CDC to get that information back. And that took about a week. And obviously, we're learning that's far too long of a turnaround time. So since then, out of the 14 suspected cases, 10 have tested negative. So I think there's another 4 out there, but they're going to start testing a lot more symptomatic people now, I think, in Ohio. So we'll see what happens next with that.
Do we know who's paying for the tests? Is it the state at this point?
I do not. I presumed it was coming from the federal government. I mean, Congress just allocated and the president signed $8.3 million allocation. I feel stupid. I don't know that for sure. I guess that was my assumption. Well, that's why you're appropriating all this money to help pay for the tests and, you know, do what needs to be done.
There was some a little bit of bitterness, a dispute between the Arnold people and the state, because they're like, wait a minute, they're letting these other big sporting events go on. Now, it wasn't like 500 people crammed into a sardine can like they're, you know, like we all know is what happens with that sports, the expo part of the Arnold Festival.
Oh, yeah, you're just on that concourse and in the convention center
it's
there.
It's elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah,
exactly,
and
what
for
you
multiple
want.
Days, as opposed to your 2 or 2.5 hours at a basketball game
right.
or whatever, and everyone in their own seats or whatever. But you're right. It's like there's certainly similarities. And, you know, the word was going out from the NBA about, you know, hey, players, you may be playing in front of empty arenas here in the near future, which LeBron doesn't like, which probably means it probably won't happen, right?
He doesn't want to play if no one's watching.
I'm not going to play if no one's going to watch me. Hey, especially the way I played against the Clippers and the Bucks over the weekend, right? All right.
Yeah, I think it's just this tension that we're seeing in between, you know, the public's desire to go about their lives, to attend concerts, to attend, you know, these events and sporting events, and we were going to have March Madness coming up, and also wanting to keep people safe and, you know, potentially not contracting a disease. So that's kind of the balance there. And then also as far as testing, it seems like it'll be covered probably by insurance or Medicaid, so by the individuals.
And for people who have neither, that you've yet to see, spectators were allowed to attend the finale of the Arnold on Saturday. How did all that go? Was there much? I didn't see much coverage of it.
I mean, I just think it just happened, and at this
point, probably a lot of people were gone by then.
Well, yeah, and you know, whether any infection or anything took place, obviously we're not going to know for a good while yet. But yeah, that went off. I think it went off without a hitch. As you say, kind of. You know, it used to be that grand finale, the bodybuilding and all that. Who's, you know, who wins all that? And that was just all sort of kind of secondary this
yeah,
time around with
right.
a little bug we can't even see.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. It's Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And joining us, Joe Engels, reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome, Joe.
Sorry to be late.
Not a
better
bit.
Late than ever, I guess.
Arnold Schwarzenegger went straight from the Arnold Festival to Otterbein University, where he joined former Ohio Governor John Kasich and former Secretary of State John Kerry for a town hall on climate change, and they're all part of a nonprofit foundation called World War Zero. Wow, bipartisanship at its best, Daryl Rowland.
Well, I guess so. And you know, those of you who saw the coverage, I think a lot of us love the takeaway from former Governor Schwarzenegger about, you know, there's not Republican air or Democratic air.
Yeah.
There's just air, folks. This should not be a partisan issue. But of course it is. Everything's a partisan issue.
John Kasich said America must lead, but there was criticism of him for his support of fracking and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, I think no one has a kind of perfect record on this
one.
So you have
market,
kind
yeah.
of the balance between like supporting a fracking, which is an industry that has brought jobs to Ohio, but obviously some environmental concerns, versus he was a person who frequently vetoed efforts to eliminate environmental standards in Ohio, which obviously kind of came to roost as part of House Bill 6 later, where we've eliminated some of the environmental mandates and so forth mm-hmm. through the legislature.
And of course, one of his first acts taking office was turning down federal money for
high-speed
yeah. rail between Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Joe Engels, what differences do you think make that the likes of John Kasich, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and John Kerry get together for something like this?
Well, I think it makes for good theater. I'm not sure it makes for any big splash of anything, honestly. I think it's just it's theater that they're talking, you know, and I think they really do have some common ground. You know, it sounds like they have a lot of common ground on some of these issues. But in the scheme of things, I'm not sure it changes anything.
Hmm. Did they mention anything about some kind of follow up or what comes next?
Well, I think this just goes under the rubric of, quote-unquote, raising awareness. And, I mean, obviously none of these three gentlemen have any political power these days. They don't govern anything. You know, raise the issue, build a consensus. It was, from what I saw, it was a pretty crowded auditorium up there in Westerville. You know, you have people attending and maybe convert a few constituents and put pressure on lawmakers and build it from the ground up. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, apparently the group's goal is to have 10 million climate conversations in 2020. So that seems like a lot, but.
Wow. 10 million?
Yep.
Wow.
Maybe those are very tiny conversations, like two individuals together. Gosh.
Well, there's four of us here. Does that count as four?
That's true.
Only 9,900,000,
yeah,
whatever,
exactly.
To go.
Yeah. But, was Schwarzenegger added on, or was he always part of the lineup?
No, he was always.
He was always.
Yeah, it was
okay.
Always the.
Did they kind of schedule it around probably the Arnold?
Oh, sure.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's turn to recreational marijuana. We're finding out more about the proposed marijuana legislation amendment, including where taxes from recreational sales would go. What do we know, Joe Ingles?
Well, we know that the people who are behind this want to use some of the framework that's already in place for the medical marijuana program. They want to use some of that framework for this. They're calling it the regulate like alcohol proposal. Mm-hmm. So it would be anyone who was 21 or over, they could get marijuana for any reason. Right now, you can only get medical marijuana, and you have to get it under a certain policy protocol. And the backers of this say the problem is that the current medical marijuana program is so restrictive that people are not using it, and that people are finding it expensive and unwieldy. And they say that they really need to have a situation where people can get medical marijuana, easier. And also, you know, adults who want to use it recreational could get it easier. So this is, they're trying to put it on the ballot. And if they're successful, they need 400, and it's well over 400. It's about 450,000 valid signatures by July 1st to get it on the November ballot.
That's a big thing.
That's a huge thing, because that's a lot of signatures. And if they get that, they could put it on the ballot in November. The question is, will they get the signatures? And then, you know, when it goes to the ballot, what will it look like on the ballot? And last time around, if you remember right, when we had the Responsible Ohio Amendment, there was a lot of outcry against it, a lot of money spent against it. And so.
Well, they had an argument that resonated with a lot of people,
right,
that it created a
monopoly. But they'll have if it's not a monopoly, there will be an argument on the other side. I mean, there's a lot of people opposed to it, and they have deep pockets. So that's where it stands at this point.
Yeah. And some of the items in this proposal are you could consume or possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana and grow up to 6 marijuana plants, which was a big topic of discussion when the legislature was considering how to put together the medical marijuana program. They were very anti-home grow. And so that's been a topic of conversation of individuals seeking to legalize marijuana in the past. This is a group of some medical marijuana growers, but there are other medical marijuana growers in Ohio that are not supporting this initiative. And so, to Joe's point, this is a lot of signatures to collect in a short period of time. It's kind of a massive undertaking, and we'll see if they can pull it together.
But what do we know about who's behind it and whether or not they can afford to, you know, pay the freight for this kind of a thing? Daryl?
Well, there are some of the folks who are involved in medical marijuana. Actually, they're split, but some of them are behind it, and various other folks who want to start businesses. But that will be the key, because just, you know, getting Joe and Jane passing the petition on the street corner is not going to do it. You need signatures from half of Ohio counties, 44 counties, as well as that minimum. And again, those are just valid signatures of registered voters, so you actually need to get at least probably 600,000-700,000 to have that cushion, because there's always several that, whatever, sign up that they're Mickey Mouse, or sign up that, yes, I'm registered, but no, I'm really from Texas, or I'm not registered in Ohio, whatever. So that means they're going to have to pay petition circulators, which we've seen a lot of in this state in recent years. But that would be the key. Do they have enough money to hire them and come in and blanket the state and, you know, turn this around in like 4 months, less than 4 months.
Yeah. And we saw with the recent bailout, the nuclear bailout, we saw the petition effort where the one side went out and really invested a lot of money, taking up, you know, a lot of the companies that could do work on this. And the other side really didn't have the money, couldn't, you know, mount the campaign. So we've seen that work in Ohio already. You know, who knows? The other just depends on how people want to spend their money. But the side with deep pockets could very well try something like that.
You know, when it came to gambling, Ohio was, you know, one of the last aboard that train. That was only after it was surrounded by states that had legalized gambling. And the lawmakers apparently became painfully aware that the state was losing out on a lot of revenue. It's unclear if it ever will, you know, compete like it could have back in the day. But is that driving anything? The fact that Michigan is now legal? Is it Illinois?
I mean, Michigan has been has had a legal operation for
since January
for a little bit now, mm-hmm. and they had medical marijuana before us. I think to your point, Ohio is traditionally likes to be kind of the back 25 on these things, mm-hmm. Even to the point of sports gambling. We have states nearby that have already legalized that, and we're debating kind still. Of where we want that to be operated and so forth. So I don't know if there's a lot of pressure. I think Ohio will do this when there's the pressure to do it. The other thing that's worth pointing out, a lot of states that have legalized marijuana for non-medical purposes have done so as part of like kind of a national push or with a national organization behind it that has those resources, like Marijuana Policy Project, for example, and they are not interested in coming to Ohio this year. So that's at least one indication that this will be hard.
Hmm. And of course, we've seen our legislature, when they see something like this has a good possibility of passing, they'll say, okay, we're going to go ahead and do it, but we're going to do it our way and regulate it our way and have the taxes split up our way. Now, whether that could even happen this time around because, you know, they're not coming back till the end of March, and then they'll skedaddle town by around Memorial Day to go campaign for reelection. And who knows, they may not even be back till after November. For the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So that might not even be a possibility this time, but who knows? Strange things happen.
Mm-hmm. We will be back with our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. My guests, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. All right, so the Ohio Ballot Board has voted 4-1 to approve the proposed constitutional amendment that would set a 16-year lifetime cap on service in the state, the Ohio General Assembly, and they've certified it as a single issue. What's going on, Joe Ingles? Who are these people and what do they want?
I think this is we're not talking term limits, right?
Yeah, this is term limits.
This is the term limits. Okay. The term limits people are people who want to restrict the term limits, and they want to make it right now in the General Assembly. What we have are a lot of people who go back and forth. They exhaust their term limit or, you know, their time in the Senate. Then they go to the House and vice versa, right? So we've had musical chairs, and as we were discussing off, you know, mic here, there are people who have been down at the State House in the legislature longer than 20 years, just going back and forth. So this group wants to come in. It's a lot of good government groups. There's a lot of different, I think Common Cause is one of them, I believe. But there are some good government groups that are involved in this, and just some ordinary people. They're coming in. They want to make it so that there are real term limits and give Ohioans the opportunity to vote on it. So it would limit it to 16 years total that you could actually serve in the legislature. It's at the very, this effort's at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So they still have a long way to go. We see that the legislative leaders are at least, Senate President Obhof really doesn't like it. I'm not sure where Speaker Householder stands on that, but he hasn't been as out there talking against it, but President Obhof has. So we know that the lawmakers, though, they typically don't like term limits, and the argument that's always given keep people in office is that this, if you have these strict term limits, it emboldens lobbyists and gives them more opportunity to get their hands on the lawmakers and kind of get what they want as far as policy and such. So that's something we're going to be hearing about.
Has anyone really given a good look to term limits, and what has come of it in the decades that it's been in existence now?
Well, polls show they continue to remain very popular. Many good government folks you talk to say this is not the best way to run a railroad. So, yeah, there's two contradictory things. You might remember that term limits were approved not only for the legislature in 1992, but also for Congress. Now, the latter were declared unconstitutional.
Right.
So now they just apply to the legislature. This whole gaming the system that Joe mentioned, I think, is what, gets people shaking their heads and defeating the purpose of restrictions like that. I'll serve my 8 years in the House, then I'll flip. And sometimes it's a trade. Mm-hmm. You work out a deal with someone, then I'll go serve in the House. That representative now will take my seat in the Senate, and you can just trade back and forth. Very convenient, but I think certainly not aligned with the spirit of the law. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of Democrats are the ones behind this. The attorney representing the effort is Don McTighe, who's,
right.
Mm-hmm. Way, way back in the day worked with Sherrod Brown when he was Secretary of State, and represents Democratic causes. They've hired Fieldworks to do signatures. That's a Democratic firm. Again, we talked before about paid, petition circulators.
Right.
We got them in this case as well. It's interesting, the motivation, though. Again, the clock resets in 2021, so I win re-election in 2020, I can be good for 16 years. Or if Larry Householder wins re-election, which I think most people think is probably a shoo-in, he could be speaker for another 16 years, at least in theory. So we could be back to the days of Vern Reif and leaders like that who stayed on a long time, and you don't have these leadership fights every few years. Whether that's good or bad, I think that's going to be part of the debate in the coming months.
Yeah. Just to clarify an earlier point, I think Common Cause Ohio hasn't weighed in on this one yet.
Okay.
I read that last week, at least, Don McTighe was declining to say who was behind.
Yeah. I don't think it's particularly clear who's behind it at this point, which is always enjoyable for reporters.
I was just told it was good government groups. And so, we'll see who ends up surfacing.
Yeah.
Another issue potentially before us, the Ohio Ballot Board split a voter access amendment into four issues. That was an ACLU-backed campaign. What's the significance of this?
Really, the effect is this group will have to gather those 440,000-plus signatures four different times, or have someone sign four different forms all in a row. It's just more cumbersome for the group. And so that's why they've taken it to the Ohio Supreme Court and said, hey, this shouldn't be divided in this manner. This is just a lot of extra work for us, and it doesn't need to be divided into four different issues. So the Ohio Supreme Court is going to take that on kind of an expedited case. So we will see hopefully soon what the result of that is.
What was the argument for splitting it up into four?
Well, they split it up into four because they said that it was different things, that they weren't all tied into, you know, the Democrats, the minority on the ballot board, were arguing all these things have to do with voting. But, you know, the Republicans were saying, well, we have same day registration. You know, we have one day registration, voting day registration. That's one thing. Then we have voting on voting day after you've registered. That's another thing. Then we have this part where you have to accommodate people with disabilities. That's another thing. So it was like, you know, they ended up, they wanted six different parts at the beginning, and they ended up with four different parts. But the reason that this really makes a difference is that if you remember the Reform Ohio Now proposals back in what year was that? 2006-ish, somewhere around there?
Five.
And five, those proposals, they were very difficult for the public to understand because there were so many parts of it. And people had to remember, now I want to vote yes on this, but no on that. And we know that when voters get confused, they vote no. And so the Republicans, you know, they've not wanted to enact all. They've had chances to put a lot of this stuff into law through legislation. Mm-hmm. It's never been embraced by the majority party. So, the chance of them wanting to put that through is slim to none.
They said that they, you know, as you mentioned, they quadrupled the cost when they split mm-hmm. it up into four different issues. By any chance, would this group shoot for one or two of them? You know, what do they really want? What do they really care about? What's most important?
Well, they've taken sort of a bifurcated strategy right now. They have gone to the Supreme Court, filed suit, again, challenging the split into four. But at the same time, they filed the necessary paperwork to go ahead with the four.
Hmm.
So doesn't sound like at this point there's any sort of pick the two best and go forward with them.
Yeah, I know they're two separate things, but I always find it interesting, the ballot board, you know, needing to divide these things. We got to be very careful to keep subjects separate. And then in the state legislature, we regularly violate the single subject rule where you're not supposed to cram mm-hmm. very disparate things together into one bill.
Well, mm-hmm. and you look at Marcy's Law, for example, when you look at that one, that had a lot of different components. You know, we passed that, what, 2 years ago? And that had a lot of different components to it. And yet it was one vote, one part.
Mm-hmm. So it just kind of depends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It all has to do with state government, right? when it comes down to it, that's what they say.
Let's see. There was some kind of, former Governor Ted Strickland has now said that he wishes he had not, pursued the abolishment of the death penalty in Ohio. Mm-hmm. It's getting to be a big deal again, whatever that means. I mean, are they all just spitting in the wind on this? Or because the Ohio General Assembly, controlled largely by Republicans, just doesn't seem, once again, it's just another one of those things that they're just not going to take up.
Right. And here's the thing. I mean, the arguments on the death penalty are largely the same as they were when Strickland was in office. We do have the problem with the execution drugs now. There's a shortage of them. It's caused a problem with being able to carry out executions.
Yeah, they're dated
right,
now. Right.
Yeah. And they're afraid that, you know, the governor has said that he does not want to anger the drug makers and possibly risk getting drugs for the state's Medicaid system, and, you know, for people here over execution. So that's been an issue. But most of the arguments that are being used, you know, it's disparatively against certain people, and that, you know, some counties are more likely to send people for execution than others. And, you know, different problems like that, they all existed 10 years ago. So I think that's kind of the thing is, okay, well, what's new that's making you change your mind? But they are changing their mind. And we know that former Governor Taft is also mm-hmm. One of these people against it, as well as Jim Petro.
And Republican Senators Peggy Lehner mm-hmm. Backing this bill. the Democratic Senator Nikki Antonio has introduced to replace the death penalty to life without parole.
Right.
Has its time come now, Daryl Roland?
Well, that is a good question. About a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity to interview former Governor Celeste Strickland in Taft. And, you know, you sort of ask the typical reporter questions, you know, what are you most proud of? What would you do differently now? And both Governor Strickland and Taft brought up the death penalty. So that's when I first heard it from both those two governors. Ted Strickland said, I wish I'd been more like his friend Jay Inslee out in the state of Washington, who just issued a moratorium on it. It's not going to happen. Now, I think a couple of things have changed in Ohio. Joe mentioned the lack of availability of an execution drug. Pharmaceutical manufacturers have said adamantly, we don't want you to use our products to kill people. Just that flat. Governor DeWine has voiced the fear that, you know, if we violate that, then that, you know, Big Pharma can, at least in theory, cut us off from providing any drugs for Medicaid, for our veterans' homes. And while the odds may be slim of that happening, the repercussions would be so huge. But what I wonder is if Speaker Householder's raised many of these same issues about more of the practicalities, the costs. Sometimes this is how some Republicans argue the issue rather than it's a moral wrong. Mike DeWine is a real mystery on this issue. Now, maybe Jesse and Joe have greater insight. We have asked him repeatedly about this, and his answer very consistently for the past couple of years has just been merely, it's the law. No defense of the death penalty, as he was, you know, did when he was attorney general, and, you know, way years ago, of course, he was a county prosecutor. Mm-hmm. So I think he voted for it, too, when he was
in the Ohio General Assembly.
Yeah, well, you know, there was no question he was a death penalty supporter. Mm-hmm. Now I think you'd have to put a question mark beside his name. And I think legislators are evolving that way as well, whether it's through cost, whether it's through morality. We mentioned Peggy Lehner, the former head of Ohio Right to Life. Some Right to Life members, some Catholic members do worry about this on moral grounds as well. So you have kind of this odd coalition going on now. And frankly, opinion polls show, number one, the public supports the death penalty. However, number two, if given the option of life in prison without the possibility of parole, that is preferred over the death penalty. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and the one thing, if you want to kind of take a pulse of where the legislature stands on this issue, last year they actually had to pass some legislation to make sure that Waverly, Pike County, got some money to prosecute the Roden case, if mm-hmm. you remember that. They were real concerned about not being able to prosecute that with death penalty specs. So, you know, the legislature went out of its way to make sure that Pike County could do that and the state could do that. So, I mean, there's a lot of talk about the death penalty right now, whether to get rid of it, whether the will is there is the question. And I don't think right now that we're seeing the signs that that's going to happen soon. But then, you know, who knows? Maybe.
Yeah. And I think Senate President Larry Alpoff has come out and said this isn't a priority for the Senate. And, you know, you need to pass legislation through two chambers to get it to the governor here in Ohio. So I think there is kind of a silent majority of the Republican legislature that is not interested in eliminating the death penalty right now. And I think because Governor DeWine has been able to just keep pushing these back because of the lack of access, there isn't an imminent death execution on
to raise awareness and to get rivet people on
the perhaps the pressure isn't there because it seems like we're not executing anyone in Ohio anytime soon.
Well, and that's the thing. We talk about how there's really no coalition, if you will, at this point to change the status quo. But the status quo, the death penalty is legal in Ohio, but in reality, we have a moratorium because of the execution drop. And I think the other thing that's changed in the last 10 years, more and more people are becoming aware of the false convictions and innocent people getting sent to death row. And they found out later, oops, mm-hmm. that was wrong.
That's all the time we have. Daryl Roland of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Ann. Always fun.
Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Enquirer, thanks to you for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles, reporter with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, thanks for dropping in, Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.